Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 644 of the Divine Intervention podcast. We're going to be continuing the 3D6 series. It's going to be series 6. All right, we'll pick up from question 47. A 57-year-old man who manages his own accounting firm has a 5-year history of malignant melanoma that has been treated with local excision and immunotherapy. He now is admitted to the hospital for evaluation of constant pain in his back and left hip and an 11-kilogram or 24-pound weight loss. He and his wife of 35 years are worried that the cancer may be back. Pelvic and abdominal CT scans show multiple bony metastases. He tells you, "I just want to die. I can't bear this." Which of the following is the most appropriate initial intervention? A. Adjust his analgesic regimen. B. Arrange for him to be transferred to a psychiatric service. C. Begin antidepressant medication. D. Initiate hyperalimentation. E. Refer him to a cancer patient support group. So for this personally, we see this guy, the melanoma seems to have spread, and he just has constant pain. And he says, "I can't bear this," right? So let's maybe fix his pain. So I'm going to go with option A here, adjust his analgesic regimen. This guy does not seem to have any psychiatric problems, right? Fix the pain first. If he's still having this, "I just want to die" attitude, you know, after the pain has been taken care of, then maybe you want to, you know, refer him for like some psych thing, right? But I think option A is the best answer here. Again, antidepressant medication, it does not meet the 5 out of 9 Sigi CAPS criteria for depression. Hyperalimentation is for weight loss, but this guy can probably eat just fine. And then cancer patient support group, no, fix the pain, right? That's the problem that is propounded in the question. All right, question 48 says, which of the following symptoms will be most suggestive of a major depressive syndrome in this patient? A. Anorexia. B. Expressions of discouragement. C. Insomnia. D. Low energy. E. Withdrawal from family. Right? So for this, anorexia, can it be linked to the cancer? Yeah. Cancer makes people cachectic, makes people not want to eat, right? So I don't think I'll chalk that up to a major depressive syndrome in the patient, right? Expressions of discouragement. Could it be linked to the cancer? Yeah, he could. He could, but I guess let's keep that. Although expressions of discouragement, right? It could be linked to the cancer, but it could also be a sign of major depressive syndrome. C says insomnia. Well, the person has cancer. The person is in a lot of pain. Could that be attributed to the cancer? Yes, it could, right? So I don't know if I would say that that's most suggestive of a major depressive syndrome. D, low energy. Low energy can definitely be from the cancer, right? So again, it could be from depression, but it could be from the cancer. So it's probably not most suggestive, right? It's just not as specific. And then option E says withdrawal from family. I think I'll take that one, right? Withdrawal from family, right? Withdrawing from your family is not as a result of the cancer, right? It can be a result. Basically, that's anhedonia, right? So like, you know, you want to hang with your family, right? So if you don't want to do things you previously used to do before, that's a very good telltale sign of depression, right? So the thing is, honestly, options A through D, I wouldn't pick those because they can be confounded by the cancer, right? It could be the cancer making him not want to eat, feeling discouraged. I mean, this person just got bad news, right? Insomnia, you know, not sleeping because of pain. Low energy, again, because you're not eating and because of cancer and all those things, cachexia and whatnot, right? But withdrawal from family is not something you can chalk up to the cancer, right? You can chalk it up probably more to anhedonia from depression. So I'm going to go with option E for that one. Again, basically, I'm just picking out the answer that is more chalkable up to MDD versus, MDD or maybe cancer, maybe this, right? Option E is a more straightforward answer. And then question 49 says, a 25-year-old woman has had a second spontaneous abortion after 8 weeks of pregnancy. She has also had an elective abortion in the past. She has been told that her uterus is in a retroflex position, and this finding is confirmed on pelvic examination. The rest of the examination is normal. Which of the following is the most appropriate counseling? A says, cervical incompetence is frequently associated with uterine malposition and is a likely contributor to spontaneous abortion. That's wrong, right? Cervical incompetence is something that can be caused by a history of like a loop electroexcision procedure, right? And that's going to cause like a painless second trimester pregnancy losses. So that's wrong. Option B says progesterone therapy is likely to decrease the risk for recurrent abortion and should be started as soon as pregnancy is diagnosed. No, we don't routinely put people on progestin therapy. It's only when we're worried about them having, let's say in previous pregnancies, they've had cervical incompetence, then we start them on progestin in future pregnancies. That's wrong. This person has not had cervical incompetence. Option C says, renal abnormalities are frequently associated with uterine malposition, making it less likely that successful pregnancy can be expected. That's also wrong, right? So the thing is, whenever you have anatomic problems in your uterus, like a T-shaped uterus and whatnot, then yes, that tends to be associated with renal abnormalities, because remember, your uterus and your kidneys, they kind of come from the same ancestor. So, but not with uterine malposition, is with uterine anatomical abnormalities. So that's wrong. Option D says uterine malposition should be corrected by surgical suspension prior to further attempts at pregnancy. That's wrong, right? Guys, the right answer here is E. Uterine position does not increase her risk for spontaneous abortion, and therefore no specific therapy is indicated. That's the right answer, right? So uterine malposition is not some abnormal thing, right? Your uterus can be anterflex, so like bending forward, or retroflex, that's bending backwards, right? That's normal. Some women have either, right? So it's not a big deal. So it's really not a big deal. So the thing is, as you get pregnant, your uterus is going to stand up straight after a while. Although I guess one association I should mention with a retroflex uterus is we may see it in people with endometriosis, you know, like a fixed retroflex uterus where the uterosacral ligament, right? So remember, the sacrum is in the back of the uterus, right? So there's a ligament that connects the uterus to the sacrum called the uterosacral ligament. If you have deposits of endometrial glands and stroma, aka endometriosis on it, that can make it lose its elasticity and pull the uterus in a fixed retroflex position. But again, retroflex, anterflex positions, they're very common with the uterus. It doesn't mean that there's some abnormality or it will prevent the woman from being pregnant. All right, question 50. A 5-year-old boy is brought to the office by his mother because of recurrence of bedwetting at night. He has a 3-month-old sister who is healthy. Physical examination discloses no abnormalities. Results of urinalysis are shown. So his specific gravity is 1.010. Glucose is negative, protein is negative, microscopic, right? We see 0 to 1 white cells per high power field and no red cells, right? Now, it says, which of the following is the most important information to share with his parents, right? So, one thing I always tell people is this, right? Whenever a USMLE question is mostly benign, pick the most benign answer you can find. Whenever a USMLE question is mostly benign, pick the most benign answer you can find. Don't pick a gangbusters answer, right? So, option A says, the condition will cease if they reprimand him for deliberately wetting the bed. B says the condition is self-limiting and they should take care to lessen the emotional impact on their child. C says the condition is a potentially serious problem and could represent chronic inflammation of the kidneys. D says the condition may be a precursor of diabetes. E says the condition signifies a serious underlying emotional disorder. Again, this boy is pretty okay. Physical exam, no abnormalities. His urine studies are totally fine. Like, chill out, right? He doesn't have a serious underlying emotional disorder, right? He doesn't have diabetes. He doesn't have glucose in his urine, right? This is not a serious problem, you know, chronic inflammation of the kidneys, you know, like we're worried about maybe like a nephritic or nephrotic, whatever. No, that's not what's going on here. Condition is self-limiting. I'm going to go to option B. You know, don't make a big fuss about it. Don't make a big fuss about it, right? The thing is, over time, the child is just going to grow out of it, right? The child is just going to grow out of it, right? So just calm down. Although if the child hits age 7 and they're still bedwetting, you need to do something about it. But again, technically, yes, we diagnose you as a bedwetter if you're still bedwetting over age 5. But again, this question is just showing like benign presentation, right? It's recurrent, you know, maybe because his mom had a newborn. You know, like when a newborn comes into the family, like the older ones can start misbehaving a little bit or may start regressing a little bit, right? Just over time, they will adjust to the presence of the newborn, right? So just chill out. Option B is the right answer. Reprimand him for, no, deliberately wetting the bed. As you reprimand him, you're giving him that attention, right? So it's like, ooh, okay, this is getting me attention. So let me keep wetting the bed so I can keep getting attention from my parents, right? So I'm going to go to option B for this one. All right. So question 51, a 38-year-old Hispanic bank executive comes to the ED because of the sudden onset of shortness of breath, lightheadedness, diaphoresis, and weakness. He's afebrile. On auscultation of the lungs, bilateral basilar rolls are heard, ECG is shown, right? Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? Look at this ECG. This is not good. V2, V3, V4, V5, V6. We see like the tombstoning, ST elevations, right? This is an MI, right? So I'm not going to go to option A, acute pericarditis. Remember, in acute pericarditis, you'll see diffuse ST elevations and PR depressions, right? And acute pericarditis is an itis. It usually is going to cause fever, and it's probably not going to present this suddenly, right? Hyperventilation syndrome. Well, if you're hyperventilating, that certainly does not explain the ST elevations we're seeing on this EKG, right? Option C says MI, so I'm going to go with that. Option C is the right answer. Option D says PE, right? Again, remember the classic EKG finding in a PE is a sinus tachycardia. This person does not have a PE, right? And the PE is not going to explain the ST elevations. And yeah. So I'm going to go to MI here. And then option E says spontaneous pneumothorax. Pneumothorax doesn't usually cause an EKG finding. And again, they will describe like, decreased breath sounds, you know, hyperresonance to percussion. They don't do any of that in this question. So I'm not going to go with option E. I'm certainly going to go with option C. All right. Now, question 52. A three-year-old white girl is brought to the office by her parents for a follow-up visit 48 hours after receiving a 5-TUPPD skin test. The test was done as part of a routine screening for enrollment in a homeless shelter. Physical examination shows 10 millimeters of induration at the puncture site. The examination is otherwise normal. The parents tell you they are shocked by this finding since both of their skin tests were non-reactive. They say they were born in this country and tell you that their daughter has always been in good health. She has not had much medical care in the past 2 years, but she has been healthy. Until moving into this shelter, they had been squatters in vacant buildings. Which of the following is the most appropriate step at this time? A says call her previous physician to obtain more history. B says order a chest x-ray. C says order a test for HIV antibody. D says repeat the PPD skin test. E says schedule gastric aspiration for culture on successive days, right? So what does this girl have? You know, she has a positive PPD, and you're like, Divine, how do you know it's a positive PPD? Well, I know it's a positive PPD because it's 10 millimeters of induration, right? I remember the people that have positive PPDs when it's 10 millimeters of induration, healthcare workers, people from endemic countries. So healthcare workers, people from endemic countries, IV drug users, people with diabetes. Another classic one is if you live in a congregant setting, right? So where a lot of people are kind of huddled up together. Like you see, she has been a squatter with her parents. Not just that, you can also see this in prisons. It's going to be 10 millimeters, right? Whenever you have a lot of people huddled together, 10 millimeters is going to be the cutoff, right? Remember, 5 millimeters is for the immunocompromised, right? Like people that have HIV. This girl or her parents don't have HIV, right? So HIV or exposure to a person that has TB, right? Or a person that has an immunodeficiency disease. We don't see that here. And then 15 is positive in everybody. So this person's PPD is positive. And after you have a positive PPD, what do you do next? Well, we want to figure out if you have latent TB or active TB, right? So we're going to get a chest x-ray. So the right answer is going to be option B, right? Call a previous physician to obtain more history. It's a PPD skin test, right? Just get a chest x-ray after that, right? Again, guys, go for the simple answer. Stop going for the high-sounding nonsense on your exams, right? Option C says order a test for HIV antibody. Again, this question doesn't really say much about HIV at all, right? Repeat the PPD skin test. No, it's positive. Why do you want to repeat it again? You're going to get the same response. Is that going to change your management? No, right? And then option E says schedule gastric aspiration for culture on successive days. No, when a person has a positive PPD, your next step is going to be to get a chest x-ray to see if they have latent TB or not. If the chest x-ray is negative, right, we're going to say it's latent TB. If it's positive, then they probably have active TB. And when you have latent TB, remember, you're going to do isoniazid plus B6 for 9 months, or you can do any of the shorter rifapentin-based regimens that can be from anywhere from 3 months to 4 months. All right, so we're going to go to question 53. 54 is conjoined. Okay, so a 10-year-old girl who has been undergoing treatment for chronic juvenile rheumatoid arthritis for the past 3 years is brought to the office by her parents because of painful swelling of the right knee. She has had 3 episodes of painless swelling of her left knee and ankle, which have subsided spontaneously with rest and aspirin therapy. She has used no medications between episodes. A physical examination today discloses pronounced redness and warmth around the right knee. And a large effusion, you don't say. Attempts at active and passive motion cause severe pain. All right. 53. Which of the following is the most appropriate step at this time? Well, let's look at this. You have a joint that is red. You have a joint that is tender. You have a joint that is painful. Sounds like septic arthritis to me. Got to tap that joint, right? So option A is the right answer, joint aspiration. B says serum ANA. Nope. C says serum rheumatoid factor assay. Nope. Option D says technetium 99 M scan. Nope. Option E says x-rays of the joint. No, right? Whenever a person has septic arthritis, don't overthink this. Tap that joint. Do an arthrocentesis, which it can also be called joint aspiration. All right. Now, question 54. Which of the following new symptoms or findings, if present, would most strongly indicate the need for further diagnostic studies? All right. Option A says decreased viscosity of joint fluid. B, diffuse increase in technetium-99m uptake around the knee on bone scan. C, positive Gram stain of joint fluid. D, positive serum rheumatoid factor test. E, soft tissue swelling seen on x-rays. What do you think, right? So, if the Gram stain is positive in the joint fluid, that tells us that, this person probably has septic arthritis, right? So, you need to do further testing on that fluid, like cultures and sensitivities, right? Because, again, by doing cultures and sensitivities, you can figure out the bug that's causing the septic arthritis, and then you can tailor your antibiotic regimen accordingly, right? So, I'm going to go with option C here, right? Decreased viscosity doesn't really tell you much, right? Diffuse increase in technetium-99m uptake around the knee doesn't really tell you much, right? Serum rheumatoid factor test, no. Soft tissue swelling seen on x-rays. Yeah, these questions in this batch, the answer choice is, like, the right answer is just kind of makes clear of your sense. All right, so we're going to go with option C for this, right? Okay, question 55 says, a 31-year-old white woman comes to the office for initial prenatal care. She's 12 weeks pregnant by date of her last menstrual period. This is her fourth pregnancy. She has three healthy children. Her last delivery was by cesarean section because of fetal distress during labor. Her history includes heavy use of alcohol and cigarettes and multiple sexual partners. In addition to routine prenatal lab workup, the patient consents to an HIV antibody test. The tests are ordered. Later, the HIV test is reported as positive. At a follow-up visit, the patient should be counseled regarding which of the following. A. Amniocentesis is recommended to rule out congenital HIV infection. No. You don't do that, right? Because that by doing that amniocentesis, you may actually increase the risk of the child contracting HIV, right? You don't want to do that, right? The thing is, after the child is born, you can test the child for HIV. And there are things you can do during pregnancy to mitigate the mom giving HIV to her child, right? And remember, the time where HIV is passed on to the fetus is typically going to be during labor and delivery. That's like the high-risk time. Pretty much at other times during the pregnancy, it's not that big of a deal. Option B says breastfeeding will increase the risk for transmitting HIV to the infant. Absolutely. This is why HIV in mom is a contraindication to breastfeeding in the US. So that's a true statement. Let's keep that for now. Option C says immediate termination of pregnancy will decrease her risk for progression to AIDS. No. The thing that's going to reduce her risk for progression to AIDS is starting on antiretroviral therapy. D says repeat cesarean delivery may increase the risk for vertical transmission of HIV. C-section can increase the risk. Vaginal delivery can increase the risk. That's kind of a wishy-washy statement. It's kind of a wishy-washy statement, right? Again, what you really should be doing is antiretroviral therapy. Yeah, D, I don't really agree with D. And then E says the risk for perinatal HIV transmission is greater than 50%. No. Even if mom is untreated, she can pass on HIV to her offspring, to her fetus. But that risk is not 50%. It's not 50%. I think it's like more like in the 40s or 30s or something like that. It's definitely not greater than 50%. Like, no, right? Many women that have HIV have fetus, they have delivered kids and they're untreated and those kids don't have HIV, right? So 50%, greater than 50%, that's a really high number. I'm going to go with option B here, right? Breastfeeding objectively increases the risk for transmitting HIV to the infant. So again, mom should be started on antiretroviral therapy as quickly as possible. Like when you breastfeed and you have untreated HIV, the risk of transmission of HIV to your fetus is about 10 to 20% actually, right? So I'm going to go with option B here. So breastfeeding will definitely increase the risk. This woman should be started on antiretroviral therapy because if the viral load is low, then the risk of transmitting to the fetus is almost zero, right? That's like the best thing she can do, right? To lower her risk. Keep a low viral load by starting on antiretroviral therapy. All right. Now, question 56, our last question. While you're on rounds at a local nursing facility, the nurse mentions that your patient, a 79-year-old African-American woman, appears to be a poor eater. She was admitted to the nursing facility 3 months ago from the hospital, where she was treated for congestive heart failure. Her daughter had moved away from the area and nursing home placement was necessary because the patient could no longer function independently. Her present medications include furosemide and digoxin. Physical examination is normal, except for a weight loss of 3.5 kilograms. that's 7 pounds, during the past 3 months. In your conversation with the patient, she says, "No, I'm not depressed. I just don't have an appetite anymore. Nothing tastes good to me. I have a little bit of nausea most of the time." Which of the following is the most appropriate initial diagnostic study? Man, this is a classic USMLE question. A says chest x-ray, B says CBC, C says determination of serum albumin concentration, D says determination of serum digoxin level, E says upper GI barium study. All right, so what do you think is going on here? I'm going to tell you right now that this person has digoxin toxicity, right? Man, combining, like, in fact, this is something that I teach in one of my classes. Combining furosemide and digoxin is not a very great idea at all. Your digoxin levels can be raised, and that can cause digoxin toxicity, right? But that's not all. Another thing furosemide can do is it can cause hypokalemia, right? Remember, furosemide is a loop diuretic. So because it's a diuretic, it's going to make you volume depleted. And when you're volume depleted, your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is going to get upregulated. So you're going to make a lot of aldosterone. Well, what does aldosterone do to potassium? Aldosterone literally makes you dump potassium in your urine. So if you dump potassium in your urine, you're going to become hypokalemic, right? You're literally going to become hypokalemic. And that hypokalemia can worsen digoxin toxicity. Well, why is that? Well, the thing is, digoxin, the way it works is that it inhibits the sodium-potassium ATPase pump. It inhibits that pump, right? Now, the thing is, to inhibit that pump, it binds to the potassium binding site on the sodium-potassium ATPase pump. So if you have hypokalemia, that potassium binding site on the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, you're going to have more open spots for digoxin to bind. So you're going to have more DIG binding. So you're going to have more DIG, you're going to have more DIG toxicity, right? So the furosemide, again, is raising the DIG levels. And then the hypokalemia from the furosemide is making digoxin bind more strongly to the sodium potassium ATPase pump that it inhibits. So you're going to get more DIG toxicity, right? Classic symptoms of DIG toxicity: changes in vision, right? You can have like yellow vision, it can cause nausea, it can cause GI complaints, it can cause bradycardia, right? It can cause atrial tachycardia with an AV block, right? Because digoxin can stimulate the vagus nerve, right? And some of this nausea also, digoxin kind of acts like chemo in a sense, that it can stimulate the chemoreceptor trigger zone that we find in the medulla, right? So that can explain the nausea that she has, right? So let's just check these ladies' DIG levels. That's going to be the right answer here. This is one of those questions where there's no level of test-taking strategy that will get you to the right answer. Like, you either know this concept or you don't know it. So, do you like the way I teach? You're going to love my classes next month, starting, I believe, on the 9th of April. I'm going to be having a 2.5-hour test taking strategies course. That's for step 1 to 3. 4-hour biostats class. That's for step 1 to 3. 5-hour social sciences and ethics and quality improvement and hospital medicine class. That's for step 1 to 3. And then I have a 20-hour step 2, step 3 review. That's for step 2 and step 3 only. And last minute review just for step 2 and step 3. And then I also have a step 1 class that I teach that is 25 hours long. That's in the month of May. And then I have a 50-hour step 2, step 3 review. Only going to be held once this year. It's a super comprehensive, amazing class. It's going to be held in the first 2 weeks of June. So if you're interested in any of these classes, just shoot me an email. They're all held over Zoom. I'm the one that teaches the whole thing. And again, many people have attended these classes and found it to be extremely helpful. You know, even this year, I've gotten people that have gotten 250s, 260s, 270s on their exams after taking my classes. They are very well put together. They are very, very well put together. Explain pathophase. I show you how these things present on exams. And I give you context, right? I don't just throw facts at you. And also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. And also help with ERAS applications, personal statements, mock interviews, and things like that. All right. And then I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. And then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com, DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower, so I do make like one or two podcasts where every week I discuss a life lesson from a biblical perspective. There's actually many people that listen to those podcasts and find them to be pretty helpful. I actually have almost 400 episodes on there. All right, so thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 645. But have a wonderful day. Have a wonderful week. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.